him. Inside, hundreds of tires milled about, their shopping bags glowing with brightly colored feathers as they wandered the grand hall. In a nearby booth, a customer held a lime-green dyed pelt of chicken neck feathers up to the light, squinting at it as if inspecting a diamond's clarity. Behind him were hundreds of skins and patches and packets of feathers piled in bins, hanging on racks. In aisle after aisle, vendors hawked hooks, books, tinsel, and fur. Small clusters of men with handlebar mustaches and members-only jackets gathered quietly around the booths of celebrity fly tires, who bowed over their vices in monastic concentration, peering through visor magnifiers as they coaxed feathers onto the hook. What the hell was I doing there? Poking around an online forum was one thing, but traveling to their convention was a serious escalation. I suddenly felt ridiculous and unsure of myself. I had a small pile of printouts related to the Tring theft, but what did I really know? I couldn't tell one subspecies from the next or which were protected by CITES. I barely knew anything about tying. Surrounded by these strange men and their dead birds, I felt wildly out of place. I slinked over to a booth belonging to Roger Plurd, a man whose name I recognized from the forums. He was tying a salmon fly before a handful of spectators. During a particularly challenging step in the process, when the slightest twitch or loss of tension in the thread could cause the whole thing to unspool, a compact, bespectacled man of 50 held his breath and puffed his cheeks before blowing out a prolonged whistle of admiration that sounded like a bomb plummeting to earth. The others nodded and huddled closer. Plurd had first caught my attention when I stumbled across a fly he had designed as a response to the attacks of 9/11. To commemorate the departed, the America fly used gold tinsel, red, white, and royal blue silk, and the feathers of 7 birds, among them kingfisher, Kenya-crested guinea fowl, and blue and gold macaw. America went for $350 at auction, but I could tell from one look at Plurd's booth that the real money wasn't in selling flies. It was crammed into waist-high crates of bird parts, wings, tails, capes, breasts, necks, for sale in his booth. One bin was filled with ziplocks of severed parakeet heads, all frozen in mid-chirp. "Got any Indian crow or chatterer?" I asked, trying to sound casual. Plurd glanced up from his vise and sized me up with a stern look. After a moment, he produced a large binder from beneath the table and handed it to me. My heart raced as I flipped through page after page of iridescent blue and tiny black and orange feathers. Why had he hidden them under the table? Were these from the Tring's birds? Was it even legal for him to sell these feathers? What if an agent from Fish and Wildlife saw us? "How much for this set?" I asked, my voice quivering as I pointed to a sleeve of 8 Indian crow feathers.
"Those are 90.
"Wow, okay." Plurd saw in an instant that I wasn't a serious customer and turned back to his fly. Impulsively, I said I was thinking of writing something about the theft of birds from the Tring. A flash of anger appeared on his face as he took the binder, returned it to its hiding place, and resumed tying. An uncomfortable silence hung, until he finally spoke, without looking up from his fly.
"I don't think you want to write that story."
"No? Why not?"
"Because we're a tight-knit community, Fly Tires,"
he replied, locking eyes with me.
"And you do not want to piss us off."
Taken aback, I looked around at the other spectators. The Whistler was glaring at me. Between Fallujah and battling the government, I was used to all manner of threats. But there was something exhilarating about receiving one from a man with a pinch of feathers in his hand. It felt as though I were onto something.
"Just so you know," muttered Plurd, "I didn't buy any of those birds."
It didn't take long for the rest of the symposium attendees to identify me as an outsider. I had come without a plan and had seemingly blown my chance within a few minutes of arriving to find out what happened to the rest of the Tring's birds. I spent most of the day walking around with 200 hefty men scowling at me. If I asked for birds of paradise or Indian crow, All I'd get in return was a contemptuous smile and feigned look of surprise. Not wanting to leave empty-handed, I screwed up my resolve and marched over to the booth of the man I'd seen outside, who had sold Edwin his first feathers. John McLean wore a baggy black thermal shirt, his trousers hoisted up by suspenders. His white hair was close-cropped, and his eyes were weary. As I watched him interact with a customer in his FeathersMC.com booth, something about the former detective seemed out of place, as though he couldn't believe where retirement had taken him. When I asked if he'd speak with me about the Tring heist, he considered it for a moment before throwing on his winter coat.
What the hell? It's time for my smoking break.
I followed him out the side door into the parking lot.
Okay, so what do you want to know?
He asked, lighting a cigarette. Well, first off, how worried should I be? I joked, telling him about Plurd's comment.
Yeah, Guido's gonna come after you, McLean chuckled, shaking his head. They're gonna shut you up. East River's calling.
When I asked him about Edwin, he said he could never have imagined Edwin would do something so stupid as to break into a museum. But, at the same time, he recognized the spell these birds cast over the community.
Everybody Jones is after real Indian crow. You look at these adult men, they get weak in the knees all over a handful of stupid little feathers. I mean, it is really bizarre when you think about it.
But he wasn't too concerned about the legacy of Edwin's theft.
There's no huge impact, he said, except that probably no fly tire will ever be let into the back room of a museum again. I go back to my life as a career police officer. What did he steal? Feathers? Well, yeah, but it's still property crime.
He lit another cigarette.
To me, violent crime needs to be locked up.
We sat for a moment in silence. Yes, Edwin hadn't physically hurt anyone in the act of stealing the Tring's birds, but it seemed more significant to me than property crime. But John, I said, he took 299 birds, and a lot of them are still missing. Where are they? McLean seemed to have anticipated my question.
Ask Tring the last time they counted all their birds, he said.
What do you mean?
They have an inventory, and okay, now there's a shrinkage. How do they determine what was taken?
He asked.
They could have trickled out over a period of 10 years. Maybe somebody borrowed one to show their show-and-tell at school. You know, somebody put it in the wrong drawer, you know, 1,000 reasons.
He paused to let his theory sink in.
All I'm saying is, based on what I know, they thought 299 specimens were taken. But they didn't know for sure, because they didn't know how many they really had to begin with, because nobody counted them.
I was at a loss for words.
They didn't count them, he exclaimed as he stood up. They didn't count them the day before Edwin came. They didn't count them once a year. They didn't count them.
With that, he stamped out his cigarette and headed back inside. Disoriented, I walked back to my car. Had I imagined a mystery where there was none? Could someone else have taken skins prior to Edwin? Could it be that the Tring simply had its numbers wrong? That, in a collection with hundreds of thousands of specimens, they couldn't possibly have a precise sense of the numbers? What if everything had been recovered from Edwin's apartment the day of the arrest? What if there were no missing birds? There were only a few people who could answer these questions. Shortly after returning from Somerset, I sent Edwin an email asking if he'd be willing to tell me his story. He politely declined. Given that he was still within the window of his probation, I wasn't surprised. That left the curators at the Tring. But every time I wrote the museum trying to arrange an interview, they sent non-committal replies, attaching press releases I'd already seen. Unless I could determine if the Tring had an accurate count of the missing birds, I was at an impasse. Finally, I gave up waiting and bought a ticket to London, informing the museum that I was on my way with a list of questions.
Chapter 19.
The Lost Memory of the Ocean. It was mid-January when I boarded the Midland Rail to Tring, gliding through snow-dusted fields, crows shivering on the winter-stripped trees. Hopping off at the town's small station, I wondered on which bench Edwin had anxiously waited with his suitcase of stolen birds. Above one hung a large poster for the English National Ballet's production of Swan Lake. The lead dancer wore a tutu made of feathers. I bounded up the station steps and briskly walked the 2 miles into Tring. Like Edwin, I'd studied the route so many times that I didn't need a map. There was the Grand Union Canal, with a houseboat anchored in frigid water 100 yards downstream. Beggar's Lane, Pendley Farm, the Robin Hood Pub. I turned onto Aikman Street as naturally as if I'd grown up there, passing the police station en route to the museum. I had sent a last-second interview request to Detective Sergeant Hopkin, but hadn't yet heard back from her. I had an appointment the following day with the Tring's curators, but having come this far, I couldn't wait until then to start poking around. I wandered through the galleries, snapping pictures of taxidermy birds and bears that had been on display for more than a century. I turned a corner and stumbled upon 2 high schoolers making out next to the rhinoceros exhibit. After they scampered off, I couldn't help but notice a small security camera mounted on the wall. I approached a placard hanging next to the rhinos. Fake horn. The horns on these rhinos are fake, because of the real threat of theft for their supposed medicinal properties. Although fake horns have no value, the market for real horns now threatens many species in the wild. I assumed that the sign and cameras had been installed in response to the events of August 27, 2011. Only a few months after Edwin's sentencing, a 42-year-old Brit named Darren Bennett had punched through the front window of the museum and hammered the horns off the Indian and white rhino specimens. With only 6 left in existence, the northern white rhinoceros is a functionally extinct species, after centuries of being hunted for the perceived medicinal benefits of their horns. In the past few decades, the demand has been fueled by Chinese men who believe it will cure erectile dysfunction, and Vietnamese clubgoers who take it as a party drug. Though the horns are composed of keratin, the same protein responsible for fingernails and horse hooves, the 4 kilos stolen by Bennett would have fetched over $350,000 on the black market. Had they been real, that is. Months earlier, after Europol issued an alert about an organized crime network of rhino horn thieves responsible for dozens of museum burglaries, the Tring had replaced the real horns with plaster replicas. But while Edwin skated, Darren Bennett was sentenced to 10 months in prison for stealing 2 pounds of horn-shaped plaster. I arrived for my meeting the next day with a simple goal. Before embarking on some half-baked mission to hunt down the missing skins, I wanted to hear directly from the curators that their numbers were correct, that there were, indeed, unrecovered birds. McLean had called the museum's competence into question, and given that Bennett's break-in happened so soon after Edwin's, I wondered if McLean might have a point. Just how easy was it to rob this museum? I walked in the front door of the ornithology building to the sound of a security alarm, beeping frantically. The guard at the entrance smiled as if nothing were amiss and asked me for my passport. As I signed my name into the guest log, I asked about the alarm. "I'm doing my very best to ignore it," she said with a wink, before explaining that it had been triggered during a routine cleaning of the sprinkler system's smoke heads. I started flipping through earlier pages in the guest log in search of Edwin's name, but was quickly intercepted by a young press flack, who escorted me to a fluorescent-lit conference room. As I waited for the curators, I peered out a window onto the brick wall that Edwin had climbed and wondered if it had been the one he'd smashed. In the corner were several cream-colored plastic trays containing many of the skins that had been recovered from Edwin's apartment. Most of the birds were still sealed in crime scene evidence bags. One tray was loaded with individual Ziploc bags, stuffed with Indian crow feathers. Edwin had drawn smiley faces on some of the Ziplocs with a Sharpie pen. Dr. Robert Press Jones and Mark Adams arrived, not appearing excited to discuss the events of June 23, 2009, especially with a refugee advocate moonlighting as an amateur bird heist investigator. I began by relaying some of the curious opinions about the role of natural history museums I'd heard at the Somerset show. Some fly tyers had questioned why, with hundreds of thousands of bird skins, museums needed so many copies of the same bird. They'd be better off selling them, wouldn't they? Hoping to provoke a response, I told the curators that several tyers had suggested that what they do, heralding the beauty of these birds by tying them into flies, is better than locking them in some museum basement. The United Kingdom doesn't spend millions of pounds on the Natural History Museum, so the stuff isn't used. It's underwriting a resource that is of immense importance scientifically, said Press Jones, peering at me through his glasses, his brow furrowed. I'm not able to make an intelligent response to that nonsense. The world already owed a debt to the knowledge unlocked by these specimens, he and his colleagues explained. Wallace and Darwin had drawn upon them to formulate their theory of evolution through natural selection. In the middle of the 20th century, scientists compared historic specimens in the museum's egg collection to show that shells had grown thinner and less viable after the introduction of the DDT pesticides, which were ultimately banned. More recently, feather samples from 150 years' worth of seabird skins were used to document the rising mercury levels in the oceans, which contributes to declines in animal populations and creates public health implications for humans who eat mercury-laden fish. The researchers described the plumes as the memory of the ocean. Many of these birds were already in museum storage cabinets before the word scientist was even coined. Over hundreds of years, each advance, the discovery of the cell nucleus, viruses, natural selection, the concept of genetic inheritance, and the DNA revolution, ushered in new ways of examining the same bird. A researcher peering at a skin through a simple microscope in the early 19th century couldn't have comprehended what would be revealed by mass spectrometers in the 20th, or by nuclear magnetic resonance and high-performance liquid chromatography in the 21st. The Natural History Museum's curators made the bird skins available to hundreds of scientists each year, hailing from increasingly specialized branches of inquiry. Biochemists, embryologists, epidemiologists, osteologists, and population ecologists. Scientists can now pluck a feather from one of the Tring's 18th century specimens and, based on the concentration of carbon and nitrogen isotopes, understand the bird's diet. This, in turn, allows them to reconstruct entire food webs throughout history and to see how species have changed or where they migrated when food sources vanished. Specimens in the collection are currently aiding efforts to preserve the endangered California condor by extracting DNA from ancient bone samples. The budding field of de-extinction, also known as resurrection biology, relies in part upon extracting DNA from museum specimens in order to bring lost birds like the passenger pigeon back to life. I realized that the preservation of these birds represented an optimistic vision of humanity. A multi-generational chain of curators had shielded them from insects, sunlight, German bombers, fire, and theft, joined by the belief that the collection was of vital importance to humanity's pursuit of knowledge. They understood that the birds held answers to questions that hadn't yet even been asked. But their mission depended, in large part, on trusting that those who came to study in the collection shared this belief. Edwin had preyed upon that trust in order to plot his heist. And now, with so many skins missing or separated from their tags, there was a devastating hole in the scientific record. The only hope of closing that gap was to recover as many of the skins as possible, with their tags attached. To underscore his point, Press Jones walked over to the trays of bird remnants and removed a flame bower bird, sealed in a plastic bag, its tags missing. The 17 skins Edwin stole, he explained, constituted not only the Tring's entire collection, but more than half the flame bower bird specimens in all of the world's museums. A serious blow to modern research. Another tray contained what remained of the Tring's resplendent quetzals. Of the 39 birds which are protected by CITES, the museum had recovered 29 with their tags still attached. But Edwin had sliced off the 2-foot-long emerald green tails from many of them. Next to the full skins were freezer-sized Ziploc bags stuffed with hundreds of small iridescent green-tipped feathers, presumably plucked from the bodies of skins that were still at large. Intact, the resplendent quetzal is nearly 4 feet long from beak to tail. In early press accounts of the theft, police had speculated that the birds might have filled up to 6 garbage bags, but Edwin's lawyer later claimed that a single suitcase was used. "Have you ever thought about how he managed to get all these birds out logistically?" I asked.
"I've thought a huge amount," exclaimed Press Jones, momentarily letting his emotions show before he caught himself and fell silent.
"We've got no evidence or knowledge of how he did it other than what he told the police," Adams said.
The press officer shifted in her seat.
"But do you think he had an accomplice?"
"As you will be aware," Press Jones volunteered, "Rist pleaded guilty. This meant there may not have been a level of investigation that might otherwise have been."
In doing so, Edwin had, in effect, halted the search for the Tring's missing skins. While the museum's curators were relieved that a third of the birds had been recovered with their tags attached, they no longer had Adele to help them search for the skins that were still missing. Or possibly missing. What if McLean was right? That all the detectives in the world wouldn't have found the missing skins because the Tring didn't know how many birds were stolen in the first place? As we stood next to the destroyed birds that they'd been charged with protecting, I felt like a jerk asking, but I hadn't come this far to leave without knowing the truth. I told them that some fly tyers believed the Tring wasn't missing any skins, that everything had been recovered the morning of Edwin's arrest. "They think any discrepancy in the numbers is due to poor record-keeping, that you're just making guesses," I said, wincing as I added McLean's suggestion that they should check in another drawer. Press Jones glared at me as though I'd just slapped him in the face.
"What knowledge does he have of Tring? Zilch!"
"Just shows that he doesn't know how a collection runs," Adams murmured.
At that, Press Jones handed me a spreadsheet he'd brought to the interview. It meticulously noted the exact number of skins gathered from Edwin's apartment the morning of the arrest. 174. The number of those with tags, 102. And without, 72. And the number of skins subsequently returned by mail, 19.
"What if I can help you get the missing skins back?" I blurted out, surprising myself.
Adams gestured at the pile of Ziploc bags filled with scientifically useless feathers and told me that the birds would need to be recovered intact with their tags attached. As the press officer chimed in to say that my time was up, I realized how animated I'd grown during the interview, charged by the idea of reopening the investigation that had ended the morning of Edwin's arrest. I smiled and said I would find it difficult to be as restrained as Press Jones and Adams were, had I been in their position.
"We're British. We're not American," Press Jones said.
"But how does it make you feel that he never went to jail? That he still got a degree from the Royal Academy?"
"If he'd gone to jail, how would it materially alter the situation we now find ourselves in scientifically?" he replied.
"Emotionally, wouldn't it have been somewhat satisfying?"
"What is the wider interest in an individual's emotional response?" Press Jones snapped.
A silence hung before he conceded.
"It's a sense of complete desperation. Because we are here to look after these research collections in perpetuity and to make them available. To find that a portion of them has been vandalized is depressing in the extreme. We will be doing work on this for decades to come," he continued, trying to work out what information we might be able to restore to some of the specimens, not necessarily succeeding. There are decades of wasted time in this.
He shook his head.
"It's completely senseless. A crime committed by people who are delusional and obsessed.
As our meeting ended, Press Jones handed me a small stack of printouts, on the top of which were the museum's press releases. Having already read them many times over, I folded them up and tucked them into my back pocket. Later that night, I dropped into the Aikman pub for a pint of Tring Red Ale. It tasted like a slurry of flat Diet Coke and even flatter beer. Across the street, just next to the police station, the town's tourist office was filled with pamphlets touting local attractions and history. Among them, a card boasting that George Washington's great-grandfather John had hailed from Tring. He'd left in 1656 on a trading voyage to Virginia, but remained there after a shipwreck on the Potomac. As I forced down the ale, I tried to reconcile the many claims I'd heard from the fly-tying community with what Dr. Press Jones and Adams had shown me. Fly-tiers had an obvious incentive to claim that Tring was just guessing at the number of birds Edwin stole. If there were no missing skins, there was no ongoing criminality, and the fallout from the Tring heist could be limited to one person, Edwin Rist. The curators claimed that Edwin had been shown the list of birds during his interrogation and had admitted to its accuracy. The spreadsheet not only gave me confidence in the Tring's numbers, but also put the lie to the idea that Edwin was the one bad apple in the fly-tying community. Only 19 birds had been mailed back to the museum by Edwin's customers, following news of the arrest, representing some 6% of the total number. How many were still floating around the community, their owners aware that they were in possession of stolen goods? Before I went to the Tring, the only number I'd seen in press accounts of the arrest was that 191 skins had been recovered. According to the spreadsheet, two more skins had been returned by mail since then, bringing the number to 193. Since the total number of specimens stolen was 299, this left 106 skins for me to track down. But what about the Ziploc bags full of loose feathers and fragments that had been recovered from Edwin's apartment? In one article, I'd seen a police evidence photo displaying five Indian crow breastplates alongside a flame bowerbird cape, sliced from the back of the bird. Edwin had severed the patches containing the most desirable feathers from the original skins, which had presumably been thrown away and were now in some landfill outside London. Surely that would bring down the number of missing skins. Fortunately, the Tring spreadsheet included a column indicating the approx number of specimens represented by feathers and skin fragments for each species of bird. I pitied the curators for having to undertake such an assessment. No part of their training had prepared them to answer the questions now before them. How many feathers made up a resplendent quetzal? If they had two bird-of-paradise wings, but no body, did that represent one specimen? After sifting through the ziplocs, they concluded that the total number of skins still at large was 64. Having the spreadsheet was like possessing one half of a map that revealed the coast of an unknown country. The column delineating the number and species of birds still missing shimmered like the starting point of a trail that disappeared into the terra incognita of an ongoing crime. My mind raced through all the obstacles to finding them. To identify Edwin's customers, I'd need to figure out how to dig up the evidence of his sales on the forum that had been deleted. I'd need to somehow convince him to talk to me. I'd have to determine if he had worked alone or with an accomplice. I'd have to find a way to break through the wall of silence surrounding the Tring heist in the fly-tying community and earn enough trust for people to start sharing their secrets. I distractedly paged through the sheaf of press releases that Press Jones had given me, not expecting to find anything new. But at the bottom was a single sheet of paper with the heading, Information from Police from Interview with Edwin Rist. Immediately, the official story put forward by Edwin's attorneys began to unravel. In the articles quoting their remarks to the court, they painted Edwin's actions as impulsive and amateurish, claiming that he'd spent only a couple of weeks plotting it out. But the notes from the interrogation included a timeline of Edwin's planning, reflecting that he'd first written to the museum under false pretenses in February 2008, 15 full months before the theft. He admitted to having discussed his plot over Skype with a roommate 3 months before he first visited the museum to photograph the birds. In the month leading up to the burglary, he purchased the glass cutter and a box of mothballs. In the interrogation, he admitted to putting an extra lock on his door to protect the birds and to buying 1,500 Ziploc bags in order to sell feathers. The second half of the document included a short list of individuals whom Edwin had named as customers, along with the prices he'd charged. 4 buyers and 9 birds were listed, for a total of $17,000 in sales. Conspicuously absent, however, were Edwin's listings of Indian crow feathers I'd seen on the classicflytying.com forum. If he hadn't volunteered those during his interrogation, what else had he hidden? Who else had bought from him? Had the 4 named buyers returned the skins to Tring? I don't know if the museum meant to pass me the document, but it was the hardest evidence I had, opening up several new leads. As I stepped back outside into the freezing air, my phone buzzed with a call from Detective Sergeant Hopkin, agreeing to meet with me the next day. Exhilarated by my proximity to the scene of a crime I was now determined to solve, I turned up Public Footpath 37 in search of the spot where Edwin had climbed over the wall. The darkness was complete, and in the distance, the medieval bells of the St. Peter and St. Paul Church began to ring ghost-like through the cold air. The footpath's brick walls amplified every shuffled footstep, and as I quickened my pace, the echoes galloped after me. I was surprised by my thumping heart, and when at last I arrived behind the ornithology building, I looked around, wide-eyed. Nobody would have seen him back here. Unless someone had been passing by, nobody would have heard the sound of a window breaking. And while a tall person could have scaled the wall, I sure would have wanted someone there to help out. I got on my tiptoes to look for the window, wondering how big a suitcase Edwin might have fit through it. But I couldn't get a good view. For a moment, I considered trying to hoist myself up, but imagined how the conversation would go if the Tring's security guard happened to be passing on the other side of the wall.
"I looked you up, suspicious copper in me," Adele said with a smirk, as she led me down the footpath behind the museum the following morning.
At the time of my visit, the exterior of the ornithology building was under renovation, encased with scaffolding and blue mesh bunting to prevent pieces of cladding from falling off and injuring workers. Large Permanex security signs, emblazoned with the logo of a scowling American bald eagle, hung from the scaffolds. She had a clipped speaking style, pronouns were dropped, and only the essential information was conveyed.
"Obviously I have been here before. Then came along here," she said in reference to Edwin, pointing to a portion of the wall running behind the museum. "Shimmied up, cut the glass here."
In the light of day, I could see that there were now bars on the window Edwin had bashed out. But there was still an opening in the barbed wire, which the museum believed he had snipped away. She pointed to the area where she'd discovered the latex glove fragment, the glass cutter, and the drop of his blood.
"Do you think he acted alone?" I asked, staring at the gap in the barbed wire. "Always question marking whether there was another person," she said, as her police radio beeped quietly on her hip. "I'm never going to be able to prove that he was on his own. I'm not going to prove he wasn't on his own. I can only go on objectively what I've got. So..."
"Did you ask him about the missing skins?" I asked.
She told me he gave her a few names, the same ones that appeared on the document the Tring's curators gave me, but that he couldn't remember exactly what he'd sold.
Their search for what was missing was limited to a public appeal. Several people had responded by returning skins, but
"the difficulty is they're all over the world, so it's not easy to do the follow-on inquiries."
Sensing that I was a bit underwhelmed by her reply, she echoed what Dr. Press Jones had told me. Edwin's admission of guilt had essentially concluded the investigation. She told me they had looked into a Canadian and a couple of Americans whose names had come up in the investigation, but that she didn't have the time or resources to track down every last skin. She was charged with solving the crime, and she had done it.
"But
Don't you feel like justice has been denied? I pressed, since Edwin hadn't gone to prison.
As the police officer, you do your bit, then the next bit is down to Crown Prosecution, or the negotiations between barristers and stuff. I'm not necessarily involved in. Don't necessarily agree with them either, but that's not my part of the story.
I knew from reports on the sentencing hearings that Dr. Baron Cohen's diagnosis of Asperger's disorder had played a crucial role in keeping Edwin from being incarcerated. But whenever I asked Fly Tires, who knew him, whether they thought he had Asperger's, they just laughed, as if they couldn't believe my naivete. Since she'd been the one to interrogate him, I asked Adele her opinion.
There's your million-dollar question, isn't it? And I can't answer it for you.
She paused to consider the next part of her reply.
However, if I had Asperger's, I'd be really cross that someone's saying because they've got it, they're a criminal. Otherwise, everyone with Asperger's would be committing crimes.
We were interrupted by a phone call from her son. When she finished, I asked her if she would reopen the case if I ever found out who had the Tring's missing birds. She said she would have to run it up her chain of command and, depending on where the birds might be, check with Europol or Interpol.
But yes, if there was evidence, it'd be brilliant. We'd try to retrieve those skins.
I left England with two conclusions. First, contrary to the fly-tying community's claims, the Tring's inventory was accurate. They were still missing at least 64 skins, potentially worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. I didn't know if the birds had all been plucked to smithereens and their tags removed, or whether they were stored in perfect condition in the attic of an accomplice who was waiting for things to blow over before he started chopping them up for sale. Hell, Edwin himself might still have them, stashed in a long-term storage unit somewhere. Second, no one else was going to hunt them down but me. Chapter 20. Chasing Leads in a Time Machine. Initially, the story of the Tring heist, filled with quirky and obsessive individuals, strange birds, curio-filled museums, archaic fly recipes, Victorian hats, plume smugglers, grave robbers, and, at the heart of it all, a flute-playing thief, had been a welcome diversion from the unrelenting pressure of my work with refugees. I had regarded it as an amusing puzzle, doing research here and there and reaching out to members of the fly-tying community in my spare time. But something changed after my visit to the Tring, once I realized the true scope of the theft and the loss it represented to scientific understanding, and once I learned that so many skins were still missing, the side hobby turned into a mission, a quest for justice in a crime where none had been served. As soon as I got back to my apartment in Boston, I taped the Tring's spreadsheet and Adele's interrogation notes on the wall next to my computer. Soon, a strategy began to emerge. So long as Edwin continued to ignore the requests I periodically sent for an interview, I would circle him, talking to those who had bought his birds, teasing out the names of other customers, cajoling them into forwarding incriminating emails, and exploring whether he had worked with an accomplice. If Edwin thought I had the goods on him, I figured, he might feel it was in his interest to tell his side of the story. Until this point, those in the fly-tying community who had bought Tring birds had no reason to talk to an outsider like me. But now that I could confront them with the evidence from the police interrogation notes, some started to sing. Of the four individuals Edwin had named, two of them immediately started telling me everything. They forwarded emails that Edwin had sent them, and they shared photos of the birds they'd bought. And they provided letters from the Tring's curators to prove to me that their skins had been among the 19 that were returned to the museum. They also named other buyers. The third individual, Mortimer, the dentist who had inspected several skins during a layover in London prior to placing a $7,000 order, reluctantly answered some questions before going silent. The last person mentioned by Edwin in the interrogation was a Dutchman by the name of Andy Bocholt, the man who was unwittingly responsible for Edwin's downfall. At the 2010 Dutch Fly Fair in Zwolle, Holland, Bocholt had bragged about the blue chatterer he purchased from Edwin to Irish, an off-duty detective. He never replied to my messages. I pressed on nevertheless, confronting those who had been named by the first two men on the list, who in turn coughed up more evidence and more names. One of those names was Rowan Needling, chief financial officer of the Montague Dried Fruit and Nuts Trading Company, which was based in a small town on the western Cape of South Africa. Soon after hearing that he'd bought $30,000 worth of birds of paradise from Edwin, I found myself on the phone with the South African. It was late in Montague, but Needling was generous with his time. He'd been a professional hunter, he told me, guiding Americans and others throughout his country looking for springbok, impalas, wildebeests, and kudu. In the early 2000s, he helped set up two game farms next to the Karoo National Park, a couple of hundred miles from the coast, where hunters come to shoot stocked game. More recently, he'd worked as a financial controller for Coca-Cola in Papua New Guinea. Needling had developed a passion for salmon fly tying much later in life than Edwin, but he quickly became obsessed. In his first year, 2009, he tied 55 flies. A typical fly takes 10 hours. This meant he'd spent nearly 23 full days sitting behind the vise. He excelled in creating freestyle flies that didn't adhere to traditional Victorian recipes. His Elvis Has Left the Building fly sported the emerald coin-shaped feather of the King Bird of Paradise. Another, the Blue Uncharmed, was inspired by the mating display of the Blue Bird of Paradise. Both species were on the Tring's list of missing birds. While most tires were wary of me and immediately became defensive, either insisting that they had nothing to do with Edwin's crimes or requesting anonymity before agreeing to speak, Needling didn't seem the slightest bit concerned. When I mentioned that I'd heard he bought tens of thousands of dollars worth of bird of paradise skins from Edwin, he laughed warmly. No. Why would I? I lived in Papua New Guinea. That's exceptionally funny, he said, like a father amused by his child's confused question. He claimed he'd gotten the feathers from hunters and Papuan tribal headdresses, after hopscotching around the smaller islands off the coast in search of skins and forging personal contacts with the Papuan community. I actually had to look very hard to find people that knew people that could hunt them for me, he said. That's not to say he didn't buy some of the Tring's birds. He readily admitted that Edwin had sold him a patch of Indian crow for $3,000 and a full blue chatterer skin for $600. In late 2010, he told me he placed an order for individual feathers but never received the shipment. He presumed Edwin was arrested before he had a chance to drop them in the mail. You must have been shocked when you found out, I offered, referring to the theft. The fact that it happened, I don't think is shocking at all, he said. Where something is scarce, people are creative. When I asked if he thought it was a pretty outrageous thing to do, it became clear that, in his view, the crime wasn't all that serious. Right is right and wrong is wrong, he said, but it's no more or less wrong than someone walking into a shop and stealing a pair of trousers. I asked what he'd done with the Indian crow and the chatterer. I probably still have some of his stuff, he replied nonchalantly. But since he had already stripped the feathers from the skins, he said he figured the Tring wouldn't have much use for them. Quoting him back to himself, I asked, But if right is right and wrong is wrong, shouldn't you return them to the museum? I would, if the museum could tell me what they're going to do with them and how it's going to benefit the scientific community, I would return them. After a long pause, he added, I'd want them to explain very clearly what they were going to use the feathers for. I was a bit taken aback. Why should the rightful owner need to prove to someone in possession of stolen goods that they deserved to get them back? Having spent some time on Needling's Facebook page in preparation for our interview, I knew that he regularly posted messages from a strange millenarian group called the Second Eighth Week Ministries. When I asked whether his religious beliefs shaped his relationship to the natural world, he responded enthusiastically, Oh, yes, definitely,
definitely. So, does the concept of extinction of species trouble you?
Nope, not at all.
But why not?
Everything is going to go extinct in any case.
But isn't this just nihilism? I pressed.
Doesn't it take away our responsibility to take care of what God gave us, if we think our planet will eventually be wiped out in the rapture?
It totally takes it away, he cried, as if I were finally seeing the light.
And you're fine with that?
Your responsibility is to align your world with God's world. His will is not for this dimension to exist into eternity. His will is not for this dimension to survive the next 50 years or whatever it is.
Anticipating the answer, I asked him if he believed in evolution.
Nope, not at all. Not even a single bit. The fossil records do not confirm evolution.
You want to talk about belief systems? Evolution is a religion.
It's nothing more than that.
It's been conjured up. It's a knowledge base that was given to man by the Fallen Watchers, which is a group of angels that did not agree with God.
I asked him how he thought these birds had become so unique, if not through evolution.
To him, the answer was obvious.
God created them that way.
It was after midnight in Montague. I could hear South African crickets sawing away in the background. One last time, I pleaded the Tring's case, trying to convince him of the various ways their collection had helped humanity, such as confirming the rising levels of mercury in the oceans.
Man is not going to save this earth, he cut in. He's got no chance of saving this earth because God has written it to be destroyed. What these scientists are doing is, they are playing God. They are refusing to acknowledge that what preserves this earth is the power of God, not the ability of man to read mercury levels.
So, Rowan the hunter and dried fruit executive wouldn't return anything to the Tring because the planet is already screwed and museum curators are doing the work of fallen angels. I added his name to the Tring spreadsheet and crossed off 2 birds from the missing skins column. Only 62 to go. After locating another tire who admitted to buying a blue chatterer, a Dane by the name of Fleming Anderson, I thought I'd whittled it down to 61, until he forwarded proof that it was among the 19 birds returned to the Tring. I pressed on, convinced that someone out there was sitting on the main stash of the missing skins. I kept transcripts of my interviews, forum posts, and other scraps of information in a stack on the corner of my desk, but despite occasional discoveries, I knew the trail was going cold. After all, Edwin had somehow managed to wipe all traces of his website from existence. I knew the classic flytying.com forum had been a hotspot for buying his birds, but the site had enforced a no-Tring discussion policy since Edwin's arrest, deleting anything remotely incriminating. As the weeks turned into months and the months into years, my search for the missing skins grew into something like a separate, submerged identity. By day, I fought to keep the United States doors open to Iraqi refugees, managing a small staff and working with hundreds of pro bono attorneys representing the refugees on my list. By night, I befriended heavyweights in the fly-tying community on Facebook, riffling through their photo albums in search of any hint of the Tring's birds. I talked my way into private groups on the social networking site, dedicated to buying and selling rare feathers, and I started taking screenshots. When the stack of evidence on my desk began to teeter, I organized the papers into manila folders. When the folders grew too numerous, I bought an accordion file. At some point, the accordion file began to burst at the seams, now with additional notes about Wallace, Kelson, Rothschild, and the Victorian era, which I'd started reading about in an effort to understand this strange obsession. Finally, I bought a filing cabinet. Even as I drew a large net around him, Edwin remained dispiritingly out of reach. I'd obsessively accumulated details about his background and the price points for each species of bird he'd stolen, and I'd developed an intimate understanding of who was who in the feather underground. But with the exception of Rohan, I still hadn't located any of the missing skins. I still didn't even know whether Edwin had acted alone. Whenever the well of leads ran dry, I found myself returning to the forum. Though I knew that most of the incriminating posts had been deleted in the chaotic days after Edwin's arrest was made public in November 2010, I spent dozens of hours searching for anything that the administrators might have missed. Occasionally, I'd find something that raised an eyebrow, such as a post from July 26, 2010, a year after the burglary but a full 4 months before the arrest was announced. In it, Bud Guidry, the administrator of the forum, uploaded a photo of Indian crow feathers he'd just purchased, commenting, "This picture always gets my heart racing." In response to Guidry's claim that the plumes were originally owned by a turn-of-the-century tire, a well-known feather dealer named Aaron Ostoy quipped, "Well, it was that or stolen from a natural history museum and sold at 3,000% profit," smiley face. "A tad more profit than that, Aaron," replied Guidry. "Just a tad more." It felt as though I was barging into a speakeasy that had already been tipped off. They had done a frustratingly good job cleaning up any trace of their connection to the Tring heist. But then, I found a time machine. In October 2001, the Internet Archive launched the Wayback Machine, which dispatches web spiders to crawl through the Internet and take snapshots of pages for posterity. By 2009, the year of the burglary, the spiders had taken 3 petabytes worth of screenshots of constantly changing websites, enough to fill 3,000 iMacs. I stumbled across the Wayback Machine while poring through the Internet Archive scans of the 1874-27-volume Catalog of Birds in the British Museum, late one night in July 2013. I excitedly typed in edwinrist.com, hoping to exhume the site I'd heard so much about, but came up empty-handed. Wayback Machine doesn't have that page archived. My luck changed when I plugged in the link to the classicflytying.com trading floor. On 4 separate dates throughout 2010, the Wayback Machine's spider crawled through the forum, snapping screenshots of the fly-tying community's transactions. I clicked on the November 29 snapshot, and my eyes bulged. It was like peeling back a layer of earth to find a perfectly preserved fossilized skeleton. There were dozens of posts about Indian crow, blue chatterer, and resplendent quetzal skins for sale, listings that no longer appeared in searches on the forum. I could see the title and author of each post and the number of views. There was a listing for a full blue chatterer skin from November 28, 2009, an Indian crow breastplate posted on April 19, 2010, a full flame bowerbird skin on May 7, 2010, and packs of resplendent quetzal feathers on May 8. Exotic bird skins for sale on July 17, and packs of feathers / bird skins on the 20th. More Indian crow and purple-breasted Katinga skin on August 31st. Heart racing, I clicked at random on one of the listings from April 21st, 2010, entitled, "Crow, anyone?" I understood why the listing had vanished from the website. At the top was a link to an eBay auction. "Vintage fly-tying feathers, Indian crow skin, non-sighties." Members of the forum, upset by the high price, over $1,000, lamented the rising cost of feathers. "We do it to ourselves by creating the demand." I wasn't sure it was a Tring bird, but when I scrolled to the bottom of the page, I found my smoking gun, confirming the identity of seller. "It's not Edwin who's the crook," wrote one member. "It's the silly fuckers with more money than sense who'll pay that." I raced over to the timeline hanging on my wall and added the transaction. Over the course of the next hour, with the help of the Wayback Machine, I exhumed another 15 sales. My excitement mounted when I realized that all the posts had been made by the same person, seemingly working on Edwin's behalf. Under the screen name Goku, this person created the forum posts, uploaded photos of the birds, fielded orders, and appeared to be handling the financial transactions.
have a friend in need that sadly have to sell his IC, as he can't afford to keep the feathers and really need the money for the family," Goku wrote in late August 2010, referencing the particular subspecies of Indian crow the feathers came from. "This cape is a top cape, one of the best I've seen in person, still very full. Please send mail for price." Elsewhere, Goku posted links to Edwin's ebay.co.uk offerings, trying to drum up bids before time ran out on the auctions. Edwin even commented on some of Goku's listings. On October 6, 2010, a month before the arrest, Goku announced a new sale of a blue chatterer skin, but declined to reveal a price, insisting that only serious bidders should inquire. When a number of members complained about his high-handed tone, Edwin rallied to his defense. "Personally, I do not find Goku's tone condescending here, nor do I think there is any problem with him not wishing to display the price," he wrote. "Everyone knows these items are expensive." On November 11th, Goku announced a mix pack of feathers for sale, including three species of blue chatterer and three subspecies of Indian crow. After a Belgian named Geert Verbroek placed an order, Goku replied, "Thank you so much. The money goes to a student friend of mine, smiley face. I'll need your addy. Could you send me that on PM?" The next morning, Adele and her deputies descended on Edwin's apartment. Goku never posted feathers again. Who the hell was he?
Chapter 21. Dr. Prum's Thumb Drive. In September 2013, my memoir about the war was published. That same month, I fired myself from my nonprofit, which was chronically low on funding. Though over 2,000 refugees had made it to the United States through the List Project, many more never would, and it was hard not to feel that I had failed. I set off on a book tour, speaking on campuses and encouraging students to tackle global problems while trying to mask how burned out I was. When they asked what I was planning to do next, go to Afghanistan, take on Syrian refugees, I didn't know how to tell them that I had become obsessed with writing a different kind of injustice and dreamed of chasing down a feather thief. On a trip to Yale, I visited the Peabody Museum of Natural History to meet with Dr. Richard O. Prum, the William Robertson Co-Professor of Ornithology and head curator of vertebrate zoology at the museum. I knew Prum was a MacArthur genius and Guggenheim fellow, head of his own prestigious lab, and the world's leading expert on catingas, which constituted nearly a third of the birds stolen from the Tring. But before I stepped into his cluttered office, I had no idea he had also been trying to solve the mystery of the missing skins. In 2010, the year before I went to the International Fly Tying Symposium in Somerset, New Jersey, Prum had driven down from New Haven to that year's symposium, pacing the aisles, talking with vendors, gathering business cards, and identifying the various species of exotic birds for sale. "I was trying to get Fish and Wildlife to bust these fuckers," he told me. He'd called the agency in charge of enforcing anti-trafficking statutes, urging them to attend the show, but one of its officers had recently been killed in the line of duty by a drunken deer hunter in Gettysburg. All the agents in the region were headed to the funeral that weekend. "I'm running around with my hair on fire trying to get somebody interested that these wildlife crimes are happening all around us," he said. "They've got tropical birds from numerous continents for sale in New Jersey, and nobody seems to be doing anything about it." Before the demands of his academic life put a stop to it, he'd briefly become obsessed with Edwin Rist, pressing the Tring for details about the affected species, and looking for a journalist willing to shine a light on a hobby that he wanted to stigmatize into oblivion. "I've been waiting years for you to walk through the door," he said as he riffled through his desk, an accretion of many years' worth of memos and journals, a decommissioned computer monitor, manila interoffice envelopes, large ziplocs stuffed with golden parrot feathers, at least 7 coffee mugs, and a Darth Vader bobblehead. At last, he uncovered his notes from the symposium. I recognized most of the names of the dealers. There was John McLean of FeathersMC.com and Phil Castleman of Castle Arms. 9 or 10 vendors were displaying tide flies with feathers of non-U.S. neotropical, Asian, or European bird species. 3 or 4 vendors were selling flat skins, scientific skins, or taxidermy.